Thank you very much. I want to say a couple words before I start here. So as all of you who have attended my lectures have seen, I'm mainly talking about syntactic structure. And as I said on the first day, the theme of these first five lectures is that syntax is simpler than you think. So I've spent a lot of time talking about syntax. I'll talk a little bit about semantics in the second half of my lectures. But I do want to say that I think that this is actually something that's fairly important for cognitive linguists to pay attention to. I mean, I hope you'll all be happy to hear that syntax is simpler. But you do have to, or one must, as a cognitive linguist, one must be able to defend that position to other linguists, syntacticians who use theories that are much more complicated. And it need to find arguments to justify why that's the case, why syntax should be simpler. Now, it's my belief that the strongest arguments in support of this simpler view of syntax comes from cross-linguistic diversity, from the structural diversity of languages around the world. That's really the single strongest argument, I think, to show that we can't try to develop a theory of syntax that's very complicated, because as soon as we make it complicated, then we keep coming across languages in the world where the theoretical machinery doesn't work. And so that's why I think we need to look at a simpler approach that can be accommodate linguistic variation. So what I'm going to talk about today is similar in that respect, in that we are going to look at particular aspect of constructions and say that they're, we don't need is something that most linguists usually assume. So here's a diagram that I had on the first day of the lectures. This is the internal structure of a construction. This is what we call the exploded diagram. There's actually similar diagrams in Lanneker's 1987 classic book. So this here is actually a part of the construction, an intransitive verb construction. And all these lines here indicate relations that a construction grammarian has to assume. So any particular element or part of the construction has a role in that larger construction. There are also syntactic relations here that, or at least there are proposed to be syntactic relations here that hold between two different elements in a construction. Then, of course, you have on the semantic side, you have a semantic structure with your construction. So there are semantic roles in that semantic structure. And there are semantic relations between the components of your semantic representation. And lastly, but also very important, is that you have symbolic relations. So you still have, you have the construction as a whole and its meaning as a whole, and that's a symbolic link. And then you have the individual elements of the construction, and they often symbolize some particular semantic component in the semantic structure. So you have a fairly complex structure here, even when you're just looking at example that has only two words, Heather sings. So now we're going to look at what happens, look at this more closely. So as a reminder for those of you who saw this on the first day, about this terminology of roles and relations. So in our example of Heather sings, the role is a part-whole relation, whereas syntactic relation is a relation between parts. I'll say a little bit more. This is again reviewing what I talked about on the first day in the morning. There's a little bit more here than in that original presentation. So there are two kinds of syntactic relations we can talk about. One I'm going to call coded dependencies. This is where the syntactic relation is explicitly coded by some grammatical device like case marking, indexation, word order, and so on. So we had this example from the first day, she loves him, and I did use these this information as one way of talking about syntactic relations. There's a second type of syntactic relation, which is illustrated by these idiomatically combining expressions like pull strings that I talked about also on the first day of lecture. And these are called collocational dependencies. There's a conventionally specified relationship between two specific or substantive linguistic elements. So as Nunberg, Sog, and Wasso argued, the combination of pull strings has the meaning of exploit connections, personal connections, only essentially when pull is combined with strings. So pull only means exploit in that context, and strings only means connections in that context. So you have a relationship between pull and strings, and this is true as long as you have a certain relationship between these two words, and it doesn't necessarily have to involve a particular syntactic structure. So the first point I want to make, I'm not going to talk about this in detail because this paper by Nunberg, Sog, and Wasso actually discussed this in great detail. And this is the statement that actually this relationship between pull and strings, this collocational relationship, is ultimately semantic. So pull has a role in the construction. That's the what this pred stands for predicate. Strings has a role in the construction. Their meanings occur only when these two things occur in the same construction and their relevant roles. Then it has the meanings of exploit and connections. There is a semantic relationship here, of course, because this is the whole meaning that has to be conveyed. But you'll notice there's now no dotted line here between pull and strings. So that's to indicate that there's no semantic relationship here. We have only the roles. Pull is in the predicate role and strings is in the direct object role. So this is an important point because what this says, if we accept Nunberg, Sog, and Wasso's argument, what we're saying is that collocational dependencies, where they exist in a language, they don't tell us about syntactic relations. They tell us about a semantic relation, semantic relationship that holds only when you have those two words in the right combination. So does construction grammar need syntactic relations? You saw that thing disappear. If we don't have syntactic relations, and that's what I'm going to argue this afternoon, then the syntactic structure of a construction, or the structure of a construction as a whole, looks like this diagram. You see all the everything else is there, syntactic roles. The whole semantic structure is the same as before. And you've got these symbolic links, and those will turn out to be very important. But you don't have any relationship here. So what kind of arguments could we present to say that we don't really need syntactic relations in our syntactic structures of constructions? Well, the first argument I'm going to give is a kind of logical one, which is to think about the role of syntax in what language is used for, namely communicating meanings. Or in this particular case, how do you understand an utterance? So step one is the hearer has to recognize the utterance as an instance of a particular construction. So if you're a believer in construction grammar, then part of the knowledge of the language of English is that there are intransitive constructions. And then through the various linguistic properties of Heather Sings and the functional context, hopefully the hearer will recognize that as an instance of the intransitive construction. Once the hearer has done that, then it's part of their knowledge of the language. So they can pull up the semantic structure of the intransitive construction, and the semantic structure includes not just some sort of overall general meaning, but also the semantic components of that complex meaning. And at this point, we just have the syntactic relation here, or the symbolic relation between the construction as a whole and its meaning as a whole. Well, once the hearer identifies the construction, at least the syntactic structure, you can also identify the syntactic roles. So once you know that you've got an intransitive construction, then you know that construction will consist of a subject and an intransitive predicate. Then the hearer can utilize the symbolic relations that identifies which syntactic role symbolizes which semantic component. So you have Heather and Sings. And so then you can identify that the subject of this construction is Heather, the predicate of the construction is sings, and the speaker has therefore understood the utterance. They've got the semantic structure, and they've managed to fill in the right fillers of the roles in the semantic structure. Now, the sequence I just gave you is not necessarily exactly how they've done. You know, much language processing, like other cognitive processing, is not sequential. So, in fact, it doesn't really matter what the order is. What does matter is that we could accomplish this whole process without having to have any kind of syntactic relation. So that in itself is an interesting point. It's that you don't have to have syntactic relations in order to use syntactic structure in how people understand utterances. But the question is, do we have any stronger reasons to say that now that we don't have to have it, but it's actually not a good idea to propose syntactic relations? Well, the argument I just gave you depends on construction grammar. It's not going to work for other kinds of syntactic models. So this kind of analysis I've just given you is all possible only with constructions which can be recognized holistically. So there's some way in which you can recognize an intransitive construction as a whole. So that means this is you can't do this with the building block model, because the building block model doesn't have constructions as wholes. It's also possible only with constructional semantics, because the semantic structure gives you the semantic relations that holds together the different elements of the syntactic elements of the construction. And of course, constructional semantics means you cannot, this is not a componential model of grammar, so componential models will not, this argument will not work for them either. And finally, it's possible only with the symbolic relations that hold between syntactic elements and semantic components of the construction. So that's how we know that Heather is the subject and sings is the predicate. And again, you only have symbolic relations between form and meaning in a constructional model, not in the componential model. So the kind of argument I just gave you about being able to comprehend utterances without syntactic relations presupposes that otherwise you're looking at construction grammar. That argument will not work if you are using the building block model or the componential model. Now, can this be done any other way? In the time when I was presenting my ideas and lectures before I published Radical Construction Grammar, I of course got a number of questions from various linguists saying, when I made this particular proposal, you know, can this be done any other way? Can we have a model that works where instead of removing syntactic relations, we remove something else instead from that constructional model? So how about if we try doing it without symbolic relations? So without those green symbolic links here that pair together form and meaning in a construction. Well, that's really just the componential model again. So we keep these components separate, syntactic structure and semantic structure. Okay, so can we do this with the componential model? Well, what does that mean to say do it with the componential model and not use symbolic relations? Well, the componential model still requires linking rules or realization interface rules to align linguistic form with meaning. But this cannot be done one construction at a time. You have to have general linking rules to link general syntactic structures with particular semantic interpretations. And most theories of componential grammar that have linking rules have some kind of principles that are basically iconic, that tell you there's some kind of straightforward one-to-one mapping between syntactic elements of a syntactic structure and the semantics. If you have a non-iconic mapping, then you're almost certainly going to have construction-specific linking rules. And if you've done that, then you have to accept the existence of constructions, and then we're back in construction grammar, which is where we started from. So the next few examples, which are a subset of the examples that I have in the Radical Construction Grammar, are examples where it doesn't seem so obvious to have an iconic iconic mapping, some kind of general mapping principle. So if you look at the first example, this is a construction that is traditionally called possessor ascension. The translation is my hand was broken. So semantically, it's my body part, so I'm the possessor of the hand. If you look at the original language, though, you'll see in Tzotzil that first person singular is actually the subject of break or the absolutive argument. It's an argument of the verb. It's not a possessor of the noun. Well, it's actually also a possessor of the noun, but in particular, it's an argument of the verb. And then there's a particular suffix on the verb that essentially tells you that this argument of the verb is actually a possessor. Okay, so the question you can ask yourself is, all right, we have a different way of expressing the relationship between form and meaning in Tzotzil than we have in the English translation. What does that mean? So it's an argument of the predicate in a syntactic sense, grammatically. Is it an argument of the predicate in a semantic sense? Well, some linguists have said, yes. If my hand is broken, then I, the body, the person who whose hand it is also affected by the action. So they have some notion of this representing the affectedness of the person whose hand is broken. Well, that works fine in that first example, but then when we look at the second example, I'll turn its pot face down. So you're taking a pot that used to have soup in it. So the possessor is the soup. It's the soup that was in the pot. You're turning it face down. So is this really an argument of the predicate? The soup isn't even there anymore. So turning the pot face down doesn't really affect the soup because the soup is already eaten. So it's implausible to say that in this case that it's actually got a direct semantic relationship. And I would say that we shouldn't necessarily try to come up with some kind of semantic argument. It's not going to work very well. And another example is a phenomenon in another language, another Native American language. This again has a traditional name based on transformational grammar, quantifier float. So in this first example, the woman saw all the men. All is not modifying the man. It is actually an adverb, so to speak, in the clause as a whole. Now, in some sense, you could say that's plausible here. It does kind of quantify the predicate, because if you see all the men, it's like a collective action of active perception. When you look at the second example, though, I saw the doctor of all my friends. Well, in this language, you can use all as a modifier of the predicate, see, but clearly you're not seeing all your friends, you're just seeing the doctor. So it doesn't really have the same interpretation. It's much less plausible to describe this as the quantifier of the predicate. Another example, Uzbek relative clauses. In the book that I read, or the book that I have read, I, this subject of the reading, functions as a possessor of the book. The book is the head noun, reading modifies book. And here's an example here where you don't even have the expression of the person, the individual, as an argument of read. So again, you know, there's no sense in which this is an argument of the noun. It doesn't possess I do not possess the book. It's just simply a book that I've read. So this analysis is some kind of general analysis that has a mapping of syntactic arguments to a predicate, mapping onto semantic predicate and its semantic arguments is not going to work in these cases. But in a constructional account, it's pretty straightforward. You have to represent the construction as a whole, so that will include the possessive construction as well. And then you have a semantic representation, which includes the arguments of the action, the participants in this action, turning the pot down. And then you can have a possessor. That little dotted line is supposed to represent that the possessor is the possessor of the patient, or the second argument of the semantic predicate. And then you have all of these symbolic links that tell you who did what to whom, and who possesses what. And that's all very straightforward in a constructional model, because you have the possibility of including these symbolic links between elements, and you also have the possibility of representing the syntactic structure as an entirety. a single whole construction. Let's see, how are we doing for time? I think I'll skip this. These are more examples that show you the same thing. It's implausible to consider the subject as the argument of the predicate. And if you go to a language like Moose Cree, you'll see that you have something where Mary is the subject of the predicate hard, but you can't even translate it into English very easily. It looks like Mary is hard to you make me believe is sick. And again, it's like Mary is obviously the person who is sick, but in this particular construction, you cannot construe it really as being an argument of the predicate hard. So it's more implausible in that case. You get this with clause collapsing. I'm going to skip these examples. I'll go to the next one. In Quechua, another Native American language in South America, you can say something like, I want to make a house in Huaraz. And what you see is you have want, and then you have making a house as a complement of want, just like in English. But in Huaraz is actually in the main clause. Now, the argument that was made in the paper which presented this data is that we have a phenomenon which has been called clause collapsing. You have a main clause and a subordinate clause, but you're starting to see the two kind of squish together and mix together. And so what happens is an argument of the subordinate clause verb, making a house, is now presented up here in this clause. Again, you can treat this all as a construction. As long as you can represent the whole thing as a construction and its form, and represent the symbolic links between the elements and the components, then you can get it all to work out fine. Now, all of these examples I've given you, I actually found them mostly in the generative syntactic literature because they violate a principle which they call locality, because they all involve some kind of dependency relation between something in a subordinate clause or a subordinate phrase and a higher clause or phrase. But if you have a constructional model, you can include structures that are both at the main clause level and include properties, elements of the subordinate phrase, and then construct their symbolic mappings, and there's no problem with doing that. So I should say, I brought out these examples of non-iconic mappings, and now a lot of cognitive linguists think, well, we ought to be able to make syntax as iconic as possible. But actually, I'm suggesting here, that may not be the right way to go. There are some messy relationships between form and meaning that you find in different languages. And again, that's where looking at the diversity of languages helps, because you may not see this in English or Chinese or some other better known languages. But I don't want to deny that, you know, syntactic structures are iconically motivated most of the time. The trouble is they are not iconically motivated often enough to basically assume that constructions don't exist. So in some particular cases, at least, construction-specific form-meaning mappings are required. But this defeats the purpose of the componential model. That's why these kind of examples have been brought up in the generative syntactic literature, because there are problems that they need to address, because it's generative syntax is a componential model. Such a model aims to avoid such mappings by using general linking principles, which must be iconic in some sense, some kind of straightforward mapping. So, in other words, if I'm back up here. In other words, the componential model, if you start trying to apply it seriously to examples from lots of different languages, you're going to find that, in fact, it's very hard to actually make it work without resorting to construction-specific mapping between form and meaning. And as soon as you've done that, it's kind of like you've let the cat out of the bag. If you're going to allow that, then you may as well go to a constructional model for all the reasons that I presented on the first lecture, where many different linguists, you know, from Wierzbicka to Alan Prince to Ray Jackendoff even, as well as Lakoff, Lanneker, Fillmore, have argued that you need to use some kind of construction-specific mappings between form and meaning. And that's really what I think is the important conclusion to draw from that. So that suggests that the componential model as such isn't going to succeed as a way of kind of dealing with the problems, the empirical problems we find looking at languages, in a way that the constructional model could deal with them, and this, in particular, constructional model without syntactic relations. Well, there's another alternative. We could try to get rid of syntactic roles. So in other words, this relationship that you see up here between that particular constructional elements and the whole. What does that look like? Well, it's basically just the building block model again. So we don't have constructions as a whole. In the building block model, constructions are defined simply by in terms of their parts and how those parts are put together. So the parts are Heather and Sings, and how the parts are put together is a syntactic relation. So this proposal is to say, okay, you know, so I wanted to get rid of syntactic relations. Well, that's all fine and nice, but is that anything special? Couldn't we just get rid of syntactic roles as well? Well, notice if we do that, then now what we have to do is we have to have a mapping between syntactic relations and semantic relations. So we have the same problem of iconicity. So all the examples I gave in the first part of this lecture are still a problem as well. So can we do without syntactic roles? As I said, it's essentially the building block model. If we do without syntactic roles, then we must have a symbolic link between syntactic relations and semantic relations. This will also require strong iconicity, which we've already seen doesn't work. But there are actually other problems with using just syntactic relations. Now I have to make a remind you that at the beginning of this lecture I said there are certain kinds of relationships between linguistic elements that aren't syntactic, these collocational relations. They're ultimately semantic. Remember, we're talking about syntactic structures, so we can't cheat and use semantic relations. Just like when we looked at parts of speech in Cantonese, we can't cheat and say, well, just because Cantonese has property words, then it must also have adjectives. Now, if you look at the representation of a syntactic structure that has three elements, if you just have roles and no relations, it's pretty straightforward. They have the first element, the second element, and the third element. They all play roles in the construction as a whole. If you don't have constructions, you just have a building block model, then there's actually, you have to make some choices about how you put these three elements together. Do you put X and Y together and then add Z to it? Or do you put Y and Z together and add X to it? Or do you put X and Z together and then add Y to it? Or do you just have X and then Y and then Z? So you can't really decide. You have to have some independent reason to say we have these different kinds of syntactic structures. As I said, my whole point is syntax is simpler than you think. We should not have to have this extra structure. And if you have a language, this is a Oceanic language, and in this language with a ditransitive verb, like give, you simply put the noun phrases in a particular order, and that order tells you who gave what to whom. So the chief gave his sister the fish. You can see that there. Well, again, you don't really want to know what structure's there. There's fixed order, so there's no idea that, you know, these two go together or these two go together. They're just all three in a row. As I said, evoking semantic relations is cheating. So you can't say that because the chief is the agent, then they're a separate constituent from the other two. But in a constructional model, that's not a problem because you have the construction as a whole. Remember, so you have roles in the construction, and it doesn't matter how you represent those roles, and then you just have symbolic links telling you who gave what to whom. Another problem you find with syntactic relations is what if the syntactic relation interrupts another syntactic or supposedly syntactic relation. So in Macedonian and in some other languages, you have a clitic for the definite article, the 400 people, but it has to occur in second position, and it can even interrupt the phrase 400. No, semantically, 400 is a unit. It tells you the quantity. So it breaks up constituents, and therefore is a problem for syntactic relations, but again, it's not a problem for a constructional model, because you can just simply specify this thing occurs in second position, this construction is inserted in second position, and then you have the mappings of all the individual elements. Another kind of problem you get is I call the nested relational coded dependencies. In a language like Russian, if you want to express the relationship between hope and victory, you have to use two elements. You have to use a case suffix on victory, and you have to use a preposition for, and you put the two together, and that tells you that victory is what you're hoping for. Okay. So a question that comes up is whether this preposition, na, codes the syntactic relation, or is it an element itself which then has to be related to other elements? You know, is it kind of functioning in some kind of signaling fashion that's coding this relation, or is it itself an element, and then we have to ask whether it holds another relation? And the tendency or the trend in recent generative syntactic models is to treat both these elements, the for and the accusative marking, as separate elements that then have to be placed into a syntactic relation of the sort that you see with this simple tree here. Another way to look at it, though, from a constructional point of view, is you don't really have to worry about answering that question. You can simply look at it in terms of, here's a hope, there's an experiencer of the hope, which is not expressed in this example up here, and then the situation that you hope for, and this na and u together jointly express the fact that this situation, this expression, pobyed, actually expresses the hope that you are hoping for. But the real problem with syntactic relations is that if it's a syntactic relation, it has to be a relation between two syntactic elements, but a lot of the time, one of those syntactic elements isn't even there. So, in this sentence in Spanish, you have, okay, I prefer the modern house. So, I is expressed supposedly by the suffix, but there's nothing, so the suffix is supposed to indicate a syntactic relation between the predicate and a subject, but there is no subject. Likewise, this feminine singular suffix on that and on modern is supposed to indicate a syntactic relation between these two modifiers and a head noun, but the head noun's not there either. So they can't really be expressing a syntactic relation. So some people have suggested that in certain languages, this is the syntactic element. This actually indicates the head noun. This actually indicates the subject in a grammatical sense. The problem is, when you look across languages, you see a lot of variation in when you get this agreement marker and when you don't. So in Breton, a Celtic language, you have a suffix here which looks like the typical inflection, I read books. So there's no phrase I. Then if you actually do have the phrase I, then you do not have the suffix. So some people have suggested in Breton, this thing is really like an independent subject phrase, even though it's a suffix to the verb. But then there are other constructions in the same language where you have the independent word and you have the inflection on the verb. So in this language, sometimes it looks like an independent inflection, and sometimes it looks like it's just an agreement marker indicating a relationship between one word and another. In an African language, Kanuri, for the object pronoun, well, there is no independent pronoun here. There is a pronoun here, but you don't have any marking on the verb. But that's actually optional. You can actually have a marking on the verb as well as the independent pronoun for you. So, again, you can't say that this thing is or is not representing some kind of syntactic relationship. And, of course, in a language like Japanese, there's simply nothing there. And, of course, Mandarin is similar. You don't have to have the subject or the object, but there's nothing on the verb that indicates who the subject or object is. That has to be determined from the extra linguistic context. Now, one of the problems with analyzing these things is that there is this assumption in syntactic analysis, and this has nothing to do in particular with generative grammar or any other particular theory. It's actually been an idea that goes back to traditional Western analyses of grammar, that if you have a morpheme in a sentence, it has to be either just an agreement marker signaling some kind of syntactic relation, or it has to be a syntactic element of its own right, a pronoun that actually stands for the person who is the subject or object or possessor or whatever. But the real problem here is there's a theoretical assumption that there's one and only one referring expression in a clause. And that one, whether it's the pronoun or a suffix, is the real participant, and then any other morpheme in the clause has to be agreement. So this is another one of these hidden assumptions about syntactic analysis which gets in the way, and I think we should just discard it. And in fact, most typologists do that, at least implicitly, because the term that's widely used by people who do cross-linguistic analysis is indexation. Because the term agreement, the definition of that term is that it must agree with something. Well, what if that something's not there? Well, it can't be agreeing, so the term indexing means it's actually indexing or pointing out the referent. It gets worse than that. In some languages, such as Modern Standard Arabic, you have a combination. So here, with the camel is masculine plural, that indicates it's plural. And then when you have an ending which is otherwise used for feminine singular, if it's combined with a masculine plural subject, then this actually indicates that the, I believe it's non-human. Yes, a non-human plural subject. So you have two grammatical facts which jointly contribute the fact that the subject of this predicate is not human and plural. And again, this kind of thing is straightforward to describe in constructional terms, where you have expressions, you have the expressions, and you have essentially the form of the word indicating both that it's a camel and it's non-human, and then the dotted line here is indicating that these two concepts are essentially co-referential. See, I'm going to finish very early. Maybe I'm going too fast here. So these are all arguments that suggest that if we do take the building block approach, we're going to run into problems. And I should say a little bit now, perhaps, about my own coming to this conclusion. I mean, these seem like fairly esoteric arguments, syntactic arguments. They are nevertheless based on facts about a lot of languages. You don't really have to look too hard to find these problem cases. And when I was first developing a radical construction grammar, I presented it at a summer school in Germany, in Mainz, Germany. And as I was preparing the lectures for that class, at that point, I still believed in syntactic relations. I thought that they had to have syntactic relations as part of the description of a construction. And I started coming across all these examples, you know, the Tzotzil possessor ascension and the Pima quantifier float and the Uzbek relative clauses and so on and so forth. And I was kind of tying myself in knots trying to figure out how can I analyze these in a way that I think is appropriate? How can I come up with some kind of iconic mapping when there's no semantic relationship that holds directly between these two elements, even though there looks like a syntactic relation that holds? How can I deal with these cases like Kili-Vila, where there's no a priori way to decide what the syntactic relations really are? And above all, what do you do with this kind of indexation phenomenon? And then it took me a while to finally realize that actually I was making trouble for myself by assuming that syntactic relations exist, and that the best thing to do was to get rid of them. But of course I had to hesitate, and I had to ask myself, can I really get rid of them? Am I actually making syntactic structure too simple? And that's when I came up with that argument about language processing, that interpreting an utterance can be done in a constructional model without syntactic relations. So it's actually That's kind of the last aspect of radical construction grammar that fell into place for me. And it really wasn't until I started thinking in terms of let's make syntax simpler that we could actually come to this conclusion. But it's also because I had to look at a lot of languages. You can kind of explain away a few examples, problematic examples, if you're just looking at a small number of languages. But as soon as you start looking at a large number of languages, then the problem cases start multiplying. And then you start realizing that maybe this is not the right way to look at grammatical structure. So what other kind of consequences can we draw from this? Well, constructions still have part-whole relations, including these nested constructions that I showed you on the first day. So it's not like there's no structure entirely. If you have a clause, just to take a simple intransitive clause, you have a subject and a predicate. Well, the subject itself can be a complex construction, a noun phrase with modifiers and an article and a head noun. So it kind of looks like a constituent structure. You've got your verb, you got your subject, and then inside the subject you've got the article and the modifiers and the head noun. It's not really constituency in the traditional sense. It's more a sense of this part-whole relationship. And remember, of course, part-whole relation is the only thing we have here in these constructions. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that, and I haven't talked about this in much detail right now, is that morphosyntactic devices to identify semantic roles of syntactic elements, things like case marking and indexation, well, they aren't there all the time in languages. Sometimes they're there, and sometimes they're not present. Once again, we can look across languages and ask ourselves, under what circumstances do we find some kind of overt case marking? What circumstances does a noun or a noun phrase trigger agreement or indexation or not? And it turns out there are regular patterns here. So, for instance, case marking appears for less prototypical reference in semantic roles. That is, if you have, for instance, a direct object which is animate or definite in many languages, suddenly an overt case marking pops up to indicate that relationship, to indicate that role. You expect a direct object to be inanimate. And if you have an animate referent, it's probably going to be the subject in a clause, in a transitive clause. So if you have something unexpected, like an animate as a direct object, then you get it coded. Indexation tends to show up for more salient participants. That kind of so indexation is there to tell you which participants are the most salient ones in the actual event that is being expressed by the predicate. So here's an example in some greater detail. So in modern Eastern Armenian, you can have expressions that describe locations, and you have predicates like live, which by their meaning imply that there's some location involved. And you also have expressions like Yerevan, the name of the capital of Armenia, which is a place name. So it is inherently a location by its semantic type. So if you have a predicate that is locative and you have an argument that represents a location, then you don't need to have any kind of case marking to say what the location is. It's obvious. The verb requires a location, the noun denotes a location. So you're in luck. You don't have to do anything special. It gets a little more complicated when you don't have everything there. So if you say, I'm eating in Yerevan, eating does not have a location as a prominent participant. On the other hand, Yerevan is a place name. So it's reasonable for someone to infer that you're talking about eating and you mention a place name, that you're describing the location where the eating event took place. Actually, in modern Eastern Armenian, as you can see, the zero coding is possible, but it's not as preferable as the locative coding. So it's like the locative coding has to be there because the verb is not a locative predicate. If you take the pin is in the box, well, again, you have a locative predicate. Box is not a normal location. However, a box is a container, so it's the kind of thing you expect to put something like a pin. So if you're talking about the canonical spatial relationship between a container and an object, then you can use the locative expression, but you don't need to say anything more than that. If you want to actually say the pin is on the box, a non-canonical, unexpected locative relation between an object and a container, then you have to actually use a more explicit preposition or postposition indicating that it's on and not in. And then the last example, and this is actually found in many languages, not just modern Eastern Armenian. If you have a locative expression, here it's a metaphorical locative expression, and it governs a human argument, so this brigand, there are some good qualities in this brigand. A brigand is some kind of thief or terrorist or whatever you want to call them. Then you have to have a more complex expression. So you see you have the postposition in, and you have a genitive case marking on the expression this brigand. So basically, the less likely a locative semantic relation is involved, the more you're going to have to overtly express it in the sentence. The more likely you actually have a locative semantic relation, then the less likely you have to express it, because it's what you expect. And this is just one kind of elaborate version of a very widespread pattern of when you find case marking and when you don't find case marking. Okay, so what happens if we have constructions without syntactic relations? Well, here's another puzzle that a functionalist linguist proposed. He was talking about English. Now remember, I just said, you don't need marking if you kind of know who did what to whom. It follows your expectations. Well, in a language like English, you do have to fix the order of subject and object. Even if the subject, it's a verb like kill, and the subject is what you'd expect, a human agent, and the object is what you'd expect, some kind of animal. I'm glad I'm close to the end of this lecture because my voice is giving out. So Dury wrote, with respect to the farmer killed a duckling, this is a classic example from Edward Sapir's book on language, it is clear that ducklings don't kill farmers. And if English did have free word order, there would be no need for a speaker to further disambiguate the sentence. Such further disambiguation would be redundant. As a disambiguating device, English subject verb object word order displays functional overgeneralization or overkill. It's there even when you don't need it. So Dury is claiming that you don't need to have fixed subject verb object order in a sentence like the farmer killed a duckling, because we all know that farmers kill ducklings and not the other way around. And of course there are other languages in the world, particularly in Australia where Dury worked, where you do have free word order, then you don't have to worry about this. So from that perspective of an Australian Aboriginal language speaker, English is doing what looks like functional overkill. We're actually having to specify word order even when we don't have to. But I would question that. I would say that actually it's not that we don't have to, because there's another thing we need. If we're trying to identify a transitive construction in a language like English, we don't have much to go on. There's no case marking of subject or object, agent or patient. There's hardly any indexation, just in the English present tense, third person singular only. So all you've got left is word order. And the crucial thing, remember, is if you want to understand a sentence, you have to recognize the construction as a whole. Well, a construction is a complex syntactic structure. There are lots of different constructions in any language. A speaker has to be able to recognize that we're looking at the right construction. So you want as many clues as possible. All of you who are listening to me are probably wishing they had more clues to follow all of my English constructions I'm using, since you are all not native speakers of English. So in fact, having subject, verb, object, word order is that fixed order, even in a sentence like the farmer killed a duckling, actually does have a functional value. It helps the listener recognize this as a transitive declarative clause. Once you've got the transitive declarative clause, then you can pull up the meaning, figure out who did what to whom, and you've understood the sentence. So in fact, that extra functional overkill isn't really overkill. It's really essential for trying to identify the construction as a whole. Because with most constructions, you need to look at several different syntactic or morphological properties in order to say we're looking at one construction and not a different construction. So constructions evoke meaning. This is a term, evoke is actually a term that Fillmore uses in frame semantics. And as you can see, this is a theme that goes through much work in cognitive linguistics. Fillmore says, or this is paraphrasing him, that words are a tool for the hearer to interpret the meaning of the utterance. So the idea is that there's more to meaning than just what is expressed in the sentence, syntactically and morphologically. Lanaker, in Foundations of Cognitive Grammar, says that words in syntactic constructions, he uses what he calls a scaffolding metaphor. Words in syntactic structures are scaffolding for the full meaning of the construction. So once you have the full meaning grasped, then the scaffolding can fall away, as he puts it. Fauconnier, in his work on mental spaces, coined a term which is probably familiar to most of you. Much semantic structure is backstage cognition, by which he means, again, there's semantic structure and semantic processing that's going on, so to speak, that's not explicitly, overtly coded in the syntax of the utterance, not directly expressed in the syntactic structure. So, for example, take the sentence, the shop managed to run out of yogurt. It's always happened to me when I was in England when I first did this. And what it means really is essentially something roughly, because of poor planning on the shop manager's part, in the opinion of the speaker, customers bought yogurt from this aforementioned shop until the yogurt ended up running out. So only the words, or roughly the words that are in red in that longer paraphrase, or what is expressed in the original sentence, the shop managed to run out of yogurt. So, nevertheless, the construction evokes the whole meaning that is expressed in that long paraphrase. So, in other words, when we talk about iconicity and syntax, syntactic structure actually does not iconically reflect all of semantic structure. It evokes and anchors the whole semantic structure for the interlocutors. So, what you express in an utterance picks out essentially the important bits that helps the listener interpret what you're trying to convey as a whole. I'll be talking more about this idea in my second lecture in tomorrow afternoon. So in other words, a more accurate representation of the internal structure of a construction is something that looks like this. So now we have our simplified syntactic structure. All we have are syntactic elements, and they play different roles in the structure. There's no relationship that holds here. When we go on the semantic side now, we have a much more complicated structure. So we have the semantic components. Now they're paired with particular elements, and they play roles in the overall meaning that is conveyed by the construction as a whole. But there are all these other elements that are evoked. These things function as scaffolding or tools in Lanaker's and Fillmore's terms. These things represent the backstage cognition, the additional semantic structure that is evoked by the use of a sentence like this. So, in the end, what I've done here is not simply to make syntax look simpler, but, as many cognitive linguists have recognized, to make semantics look more complicated, or semantics look richer. I think this is a reason why so many cognitive linguists devote their attention to the study of semantic structure, because there's so much interesting and complicated things going on that are kind of wide open to be analyzed, since in Western culture, at least, linguistics for so many decades focused its attention on grammatical structure and not on meaning. But to repeat a point that I made at the beginning, I think it's very important that we actually look at syntactic structure and make the arguments that syntactic structure is simpler than we traditionally thought, at the same time that we're also showing that semantic structure is more complex and richer than we previously assumed. So thank you very much. I'm sorry, I should have, didn't actually repeat those conclusions, but there they are. You've probably looked at them already. It's just, sorry, let me, can I just go through my conclusions? I didn't realize I had that extra slide. Sorry. So just to repeat, so we'd have this minimal syntactic structure, just the construction as a whole and the syntactic elements that play roles. The second bullet point, something I didn't mention before, and I should mention, emphasize that, that, you know, linguists had proposed syntactic relations to, in order to capture facts or generalizations about languages. Those generalizations still need to be captured, even if we get rid of syntactic relations. And most of them should be, if they're valid at all, they can be captured by the symbolic links between elements of the construction and their semantic components. And then that skeletal syntactic structure, as I emphasize, is sufficient to evoke the much richer semantic structure whose communication is the functional goal of grammar. So now I'm really done. Thank you.